Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCALP 106.1 FM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, September 3rd, 2005. Today our focus is Back to School, looking at education issues as our kids head back to school. In our first hour, we'll talk with Durham, New Hampshire public school teachers Melinda Salazar and Kay Morgan about teaching peace in local public schools. In our second hour, we'll hear from Megan Mattson from the Leave My Child Alone campaign about military recruitment in the schools, and an interview with retired public school teacher Mike Vivas on the assault on education. We'll also have music, announcements, and more. So stay tuned. First, for some news.
This is Steve Diamond with some news. Our first story from the Associated Press. Bush gives new reason for the Iraq war, says U.S. must prevent oil fields from falling into the hands of terrorists. President Bush answered growing anti-war protests yesterday with a fresh reason for U.S. troops to continue fighting in Iraq, protection of the country's vast oil fields, which he said would otherwise fall under the control of terrorist extremists. The president, standing against a backdrop of the USS Ronald Reagan, the newest aircraft carrier in the Navy's fleet, said terrorists would be denied their goal of making Iraq a base from which to recruit followers, train them, and finance attacks. Bush said, "We will defeat the terrorists. We will build a free Iraq that will fight terrorists instead of giving them aid and sanctuary." The speech was Bush's third in just over a week, defending his Iraq policies, as the White House scrambles to counter growing public concern about the war. At the naval base, Bush also declared, "If Zarqawi and Osama bin Laden gain control of Iraq, they would create a new training ground for future terrorist attacks. They'd seize oil fields to fund their ambitions. They could recruit more terrorists by claiming a historic victory over the United States and our coalition." Our next story, from the New York Times. The Iraq War could cost each American family $11,000. The cost of the Iraq War goes well beyond the more than $250 billion already spent on military operations and reconstruction. Basic running costs of the current conflict are $6 billion a month, a figure that reflects the Pentagon's unprecedented reliance on expensive private contractors. Other factors keeping costs high include inducements for recruits and for military personnel serving second and third deployments, extra pay for reservists and members of the National Guard, as well as more than $2 billion a year in additional foreign aid to Jordan, Pakistan, Turkey, and others to reward their cooperation in Iraq and Afghanistan. The bill for repairing and replacing military hardware is $20 billion a year, according to figures from the Congressional Budget Office. But the biggest long-term costs are disability and health payments for the returning troops, which will be incurred even if hostilities were to stop tomorrow. The United States currently pays more than $2 billion in disability claims per year for 159,000 veterans of the 1991 Gulf War, even though that conflict lasted only 5 weeks, with 148 dead and 467 wounded. Even assuming that the 525,000 American troops who have so far served in Iraq and Afghanistan will require treatment only on the same scale as their predecessors from the Gulf War, these payments are likely to run at $7 billion a year for the next 45 years. If the American military presence in the region lasts another 5 years, the total outlay for the war could stretch to more than $1.3 trillion, or $11,300 for every household in the United States. And from the British Independent, Iraqi activist taken up by Bush recants her views. Back in February, with blue ink on her finger, symbolizing the recent Iraqi election in which she had just voted, Safiya Taleb al-Suhail was invited to sit with the First Lady, Laura Bush, and listen to the President claim in his State of the Union address that success was being achieved in Iraq. Her picture went around the world after she turned to hug Janet Norwood, a Texas woman whose son had been killed in Iraq. But now it appears Ms. Suhail, an anti-Saddam activist who became Iraq's ambassador to Egypt, may be having second thoughts about the supposed success she celebrated with a two-fingered victory sign. Having seen the negotiations for the country's constitution fall into disarray and the prospect of a secular constitution severely undermined, she expressed her concern last week. "When we came back from exile, we thought we were going to improve rights and the position of women. But look what has happened. We have lost all the gains we made over the past 30 years. It's a big disappointment. human rights should not be linked to Islamic Sharia law at all. They should be listed separately in the Constitution. And from Reuters, Venezuela to seek legal action against Pat Robertson. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez said his government would take legal action against Pat Robertson and potentially seek his extradition after the U.S. evangelist called for Washington to assassinate the South American leader. Chavez said in a televised speech, "I announce that my government is going to take legal action in the United States. To call for the assassination of a head of state is an act of terrorism." The fiery left-wing critic of Bush's foreign policy, who frequently charges the U.S. government is plotting to kill him, called Robertson crazy and a public menace. He said Venezuela could seek Robertson's extradition under international treaties and take its claim to the United Nations if the Bush administration did not act. Robertson, the founder of the Christian Coalition and a leader of the Christian right that has backed Bush, said on Monday that if Chavez, quote, "thinks we're trying to assassinate him, I think that we really ought to go ahead and do it." Relations between Chavez and the United States, the top buyer of the OPEC nation's oil, have deteriorated since Chavez survived a brief 2002 coup he said was backed by U.S. authorities. And from In These Times, Radioactive Wounds of War. Gerard Matthew returned from his Iraq tour a year and a half ago, alive and in one piece. But after the New York State National Guardsmen got home, he learned that a bunkmate, Sergeant Ray Ramos, and a group of guard members from another unit had accepted an offer by the New York Daily News and reporter Juan Gonzalez to be tested for depleted uranium contamination, and had tested positive. Matthew, 31, decided that since he'd spent much of his time in Iraq lugging around DU-damaged equipment, he'd better get tested too. It turned out that he was the most contaminated of them all. Matthew immediately urged his wife to get an ultrasound check of their unborn baby. They discovered the fetus had a condition common to those with radioactive exposure, atypical syndactyly. The right hand had only two digits. Matthew feels guilty for causing her deformity and angry at a government that never warned him about DU's dangers. U.S. forces first used depleted uranium in the 1991 Gulf War, when some 300 tons of depleted uranium, the waste product of nuclear power plants and weapons facilities, were used in tank shells and shells fired by A-10 jets. In the current wars in Afghanistan and especially Iraq, more than 1,000 tons of depleted uranium has been used in Afghanistan and more than 3,000 tons used in Iraq. And while depleted uranium was fired mostly in the desert during the Gulf War, in the current war in Iraq, most of the DU munitions are exploding in populated urban areas. The Pentagon has expanded depleted uranium use into bunker-busting bombs, anti-personnel bomblets, and even in M16 and pistol shells. The military loves depleted uranium for its unique penetration capability. There is no debate regarding its chemical toxicity. According to Mount Sinai pathologist Thomas Fazy, who participated in the New York Guard unit testing, the element has an affinity for bonding with DNA, where even trace amounts can cause cancers and fetal abnormalities. At the war's start, the United States refused to allow UN or other environmental inspectors to test DU levels within Iraq. Now, the United Nations won't even go near Iraq because of security concerns. Ramos says, "It doesn't seem right that we are poisoning the places we are supposed to be liberating." Connecticut State Representative Pat Dillon, a Yale-trained epidemiologist, has crafted state-level legislation that Connecticut and Louisiana have unanimously passed, authorizing returned National Guard troops to request and receive specialized depleted uranium contamination tests at the Pentagon's expense. This approach bypasses the Pentagon's feet-dragging because National Guard troops fall under state rather than federal jurisdiction. Representative Dillon says, "This was not a Democratic or Republican issue. These are our kids, and someone needs to protect them." She added that since passage of her bill, which takes effect this October, military groups and family organizations, state legislators, and even National Guard unit commanders have contacted her for copies of her bill to promote in their states. Bob Smith, a veteran in Louisiana who got hold of Dillon's bill and spearheaded a successful effort to pass similar legislation in Louisiana, claims that 14 to 20 other states are considering similar measures. If enough Guard troops avail themselves of the testing and start testing positive for contamination, it seems likely that reservists and active duty troops and veterans will demand similar access to rigorous tests, which can cost upwards of $1,000 per person. One way or another, the Pentagon will pay a price. Dr. Doug Roque, a health physicist at the University of Illinois who headed up a Pentagon study of depleted uranium weapons in the mid-90s, says, "Depleted uranium is a war crime. It's that simple. Once you've scattered all this stuff around and then refused to clean it up, you've committed a war crime." That story was available on Truth Out. And next, from Raw Story, ACLU reveals FBI labeled peace and affirmative action groups terrorists. The American Civil Liberties Union released an FBI document that designates a Michigan-based peace group and an affirmative action advocacy group as potentially involved in terrorist activities. The file was obtained through an ongoing nationwide ACLU effort seeking information on the FBI's use of joint terrorism task forces to engage in political surveillance. ACLU affiliates in 15 additional states have filed similar requests on behalf of more than 100 groups and individuals. Sarah McDonald, a recent graduate of Michigan State University and a member of one of the groups questioned, said, "We're disturbed and dismayed that the FBI is misusing its power by spying on anti-war groups and monitoring political dissent. We've protested the war, racial discrimination, and the military recruitment of high school students, but we're certainly not a terrorist group." And from TomPaine.com, Washington is demanding 450 changes to the action agenda that will culminate at the September 2005 United Nations Summit. The General Assembly's package of proposed reforms, emerging after 9 months of negotiations ahead of the summit, begins with new commitments to implement the Millennium Development Goals established in 2000 as a set of international commitments aimed at reducing poverty by 2015. They have yet to be implemented. The 2005 Millennium Plus 5 Summit intended to shore up the unmet commitments to those goals. In his reform proposals of March 2005, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan called on governments north and south to see the implementation of the Millennium Development Goals as a minimum requirement. Without at least that minimal level of poverty alleviation, he said, conflicts within and between states could spiral out of control. The Bush administration's 450 proposed changes begin by systematically deleting every one of the 35 specific references to the Millennium Development Goals. Helping the poorest countries, especially those in Africa, to deal with the impact of climate change is deleted. The proposal puts at great risk treaties to which the United States is already a party, including the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The UN summit draft referred to the NPT's three pillars. States without nuclear weapons would agree never to build or obtain them, but in return they would be guaranteed the right to produce nuclear energy for peaceful use. In return, recognized nuclear weapons states commit to eliminating all nuclear weapons. The proposed U.S. changes delete all reference to this commitment. The U.S. deleted the statement that, quote, the use of force should be considered as an instrument of last resort. Washington narrowed the definition of the right of self-determination of peoples to eliminate those who, quote, remain under colonial domination and foreign occupation. On migration, the original language focused on enhancing international cooperation, linking migrant worker issues and development, and the human rights of migrants. The U.S. wants to replace it with, quote, the sovereign right of states to formulate and enforce national migration policies, with international cooperation only to facilitate national laws. Reference to human rights was deleted. That story was from excerpts of a paper written by Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. And finally, from Reuters, Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco warned rioters and looters in New Orleans on Thursday that National Guard troops are under her orders to, quote, shoot and kill to end the rampant violence in the city in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Announcing the arrival of 300 Arkansas National Guard troops in New Orleans, fresh from service in Iraq, Blanco said, quote, these troops are battle-tested. They have M16s and are locked and loaded. These troops know how to shoot and kill, and I expect they will, she said.
I want to welcome our listeners once again to yet another interview segment here today on Making Waves. Once again, I'm your host, Damon Thomas, and my guests for this portion of the show are Kay Morgan and Melinda Salazar, two Seacoast area educators who have undertaken the task of teaching peace in the public schools. I encourage all of our listeners to stay tuned to what promises to be an informative and engaging discussion of their work and of the positive impact it has had on the students who participate. First off, Kay and Melinda, welcome to Making Waves, and thank you for taking the time to be here.
Thank you for inviting us, Damon. We're very happy to join you this afternoon to share our thoughts about teaching peace and peace education in the Seacoast area.
And I'm delighted to be here and have an opportunity to share our thoughts and our experiences in teaching peace.
Thank you both. And I thought I would begin by asking each of you to provide our listeners maybe with some brief background information about yourselves, specifically what teaching positions you currently hold, where that is, what grade levels, maybe how you happen to have come to be there and how you maybe happened upon each other.
Sure. I'm an English teacher at Oyster River High School, and in that position I teach grades 9 through 12 in various elective classes. I came to the Seacoast in 1983, and I've been at Oyster River since 1986. I started teaching peace studies in the curriculum here just 2 years ago. So I'm, in that sense, I'm almost a neophyte when it comes to peace education, but I hope that I have developed a course that is meaningful to students, and I'll talk more about that in just a minute.
I wear a couple of different academic hats. In my capacity at Oyster River High School, I teach in the Social Studies Department. We have a freshman required class that we call World Cultures, which really expands upon the state requirement of a global geography to include the study of the peoples of the world and the political and economic systems in which they live. I teach a new course entitled Citizenship Education, which was initially designed to be a 10th grade government class. And I had the great opportunity last year to train with the Cloud Institute for Sustainability Education in New York City, where they, in collaboration with the New York City Public Schools and the Gazelle Institute and some other educational organizations, designed a course entitled Inventing the Future, Leadership and Participation for the 21st Century. And it's a wonderful opportunity for students to not just learn about a representational democracy, but actually a participatory democracy. How is it that students develop the skills that lead them to be active participants in the decision-making processes in our nation and in the world? I also teach at the University of New Hampshire in the Women's Studies Department.
Your work has been described as teaching peace. Could you elaborate on that by defining what is meant by teaching peace and how that work translates into your classroom experience?
First of all, I teach the peace studies class, so that's an obvious connection. But I think beyond that, in terms of translating into the rest of the classes I teach, I try to create an environment in which all voices are valued, also in which students have a great deal of choice and take a great deal of responsibility for what they do. And certainly conflict resolution is a focal point in any classroom, so I hope that I help students learn methods of resolving conflict. So I guess in those ways I would see that teaching peace transcends my peace studies class, and I hope that I'm encouraging students to think about their actions and how they impact someone else and how they react to conflict.
I would agree with Kay. How we define peace determines what we have to say about it. And so I would say confidently that whenever teachers educate their students about removing the conditions of war and violence, every time they encourage their students to use their words and not their bodies or physical action to resolve conflict, they're doing peace, they're peacemaking. This kind of peacemaking, peace scholars would call educating for a negative peace. The other kind, or the deeper, more transformative level of teaching peace, what scholars would call teaching for a positive peace, is less obvious. Not many teachers problematize justice and unity as conditions that are necessary for creating a culture of peace. But justice and unity, the unity of humankind, are fundamental prerequisites for peace, and these ethical and spiritual conditions are actually a little bit harder to find their way into the classroom. The inclusions of values in a peace education curriculum looks at the inequities in our global economic system. It looks at environmental degradation. It examines gender inequities. And the ways in which teachers take the curriculum and creatively pick it apart for ways to get at these inequities is teaching for a deeper level of peace.
And does your work consist of, just so our listeners may understand and I can understand it better, does it consist of a particular course, or is it a method of teaching that transcends a particular course and carries over into a number of disciplines?
Well, let me talk a little bit about the peace studies course, the curriculum in that course. Some of what Melinda has just said is certainly appropriate to the way I try to present that class to students. We start with a unit in which they attempt to define peace, and many times their first definition is peace is the absence of conflict or the absence of war. And that certainly is a part of the definition, but I try to move them beyond that to think about peace as a positive construct. So to that end, we read Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Being Peace. one of the quotes from that book that I like a lot is, peace begins with me, let me begin with peace. So we bring it to a very individual level and think about what students do in their own lives that can create peace in their own segment of the world, and then we move outward from there kind of in concentric circles. I think also as an English teacher, however, that anytime we talk about literature, we're talking about plot, and we're talking about conflict, and we're talking about characters and interactions. So in that sense, the curriculum of peace can easily come up in just about any class that I teach. One class, again, that's not literature-based is debate and persuasion. Well, we're going to do a lot of debating and persuading on issues of current interest. So there are many opportunities, not for me to force things down students' throats, but rather to ask them to think critically about important issues of social justice, war, peace, environmental sustainability, and issues of that nature. So I would say that in terms of curricularly, the idea of peace often comes up in ways that you might not on first glance think that it would. And then secondly is a method of organizing and teaching your classes that promotes a peaceful interaction among the students and between students and teachers and among teachers in the school. So I think we are trying to establish a culture of peace at Oyster River High School, partly in response to some of the violence, the overt violence in schools that we've seen around our country, and partly because we all believe in it. Or I can't say that everyone on the faculty does, but I would venture a guess that most people support that as a way of approaching their classroom interaction.
The nature of public schools, particularly those that track students, fosters competitive attitudes. And I think if we've learned anything from school violence, the school violences in this country over the last 10 years, is that students who identify themselves as different or who are marginalized have sought ways that are not constructive and helpful. So hopefully in our classrooms setting, how we arrange our classrooms in circles as compared to teachers sitting up in front, the way we design and adapt curriculum to be more student-centered, the ways in which schools have incorporated issues of diversity into their school activities, these are all ways in which students get the message that we move beyond just tolerating each other's differences, but we develop skills and how do we accept others.
I take it to mean that you would employ the use of lectures or videos or books, literature, certainly, roundtable discussions in your coursework?
Well, I think that we try to create an interactive environment. That is to say, very rarely would either of us be in front of the class lecturing. That's not a way to engage students, in my opinion. So I would think that a project-based approach is more along the lines of defining what I would do in my classroom. We certainly read, we write a lot, we have lots of discussion. Today, for example, I would go right around the circle so that we hear from everyone in a class in answer to a question or posing a thoughtful passage for them to talk about. So those kinds of methods, I think, puts the teacher as part of the learning community. I like to sit in the circle with my students, and not to say that I won't get up and go to the board and, you know, write some notes or put some important points up, but in general, it's much more of a collaborative and interactive atmosphere in order to try to engage students in whatever the topic might be. And I think both Melinda and I also try to incorporate a lot of art into our program. Is that another way for students to express what they know? It isn't just always writing a paper, but it's often thinking of a more creative way to transform the information that they may have taken from a unit. So a whole lot of different ways of trying to create that culture in the classroom.
In addition to trying to alter the way in which information is introduced and processed visually, hands-on, auditorily, I also adapt the curriculum such that students are making their own books. So every class that I have, we go through a very elaborate and almost a ceremonial bookmaking process. where their first assignment at the beginning of school is to eat a pizza, and to the next day bring their pizza box in, from which we make books, sew pages in, and all of their assignments, whether it actually is a rather dry, sort of more definition-oriented vocabulary type of an assignment, because I do teach in the social sciences, they have opportunities to translate and to transform that data into a very interesting graphic, visual, often interactive, what I call a canvas for their book page. Their midterm and their final for my classes are a culminating project where they're able to cover their book with the central, that reflects the central question of the course. And their introductory essay that goes in the beginning of the book and their afterwards both are central questions, and rather than testing them for knowledge gained that they may forget a week after they've crammed for the test, it has far more meaning. I've had my students tell me that while they ended up working twice as hard as they would have studied for a test, they certainly did gain more by putting this knowledge that they've gained in their books. And then at the end of every course, every student has a book that they walk away with, which is their portfolio of work accomplished during this course.
To what extent and in what ways, if any, do the students help to shape the curriculum?
Well, student choice is an important part of our whole English department philosophy at Oyster River, so that, in fact, in terms of looking at the broad department, we have only one class that we require all students to take as ninth graders called Essentials of High School English. And after that, they get to choose one semester long electives. We are heterogeneously grouped so that we have grades 10, 11, and 12 in most of our elective classes. So student choice begins at that level, and then if you come down to the classroom level, I wouldn't say that students entirely create the curriculum, that would be incorrect, but certainly within a framework that we provide, they have latitude to choose. So for example, in my debate and persuasion class, I don't come in and assign what the topic is for the next debate. We as a class will brainstorm multiple topics and then by class vote arrive at the final topic. Similar kinds of choices exist in most of our classes. In our writing classes, for example, students will choose the topic on which they wish to write. So there's a lot of choice, and then on the other side, if you were to ask students, they would probably say, no, there's not a lot of choice. We have to read certain novels. Yes, they do have to read certain things, but in the day-to-day way that the classroom is organized, they have a lot of say. In the Peace Studies class, I will actually ask them on the very first day to make a list of what they would like to learn about peace, and I already have a list of things that I hope to share with them and expose them to. Very often their list is similar, if not identical, to mine. There's no sense in really trying to bring kids into your room for 50 minutes every day or 90 minutes every day if they're not invested in what they're doing. So I think, and as Melinda mentioned, to create citizens in a democracy who are participants rather than spectators, we want to engage students. We want them involved in the process of decision making so that in the outside world they have some skills at doing that once they have left their 12 years of high school.
Now that's a really interesting question, because certainly our school boards would not want to hear us say that our students shape the curriculum. It's the school boards that really, and in collaboration with teachers, that really do write curriculum. But it's as we talked about earlier, there's a difference between student-shaped curriculum and a student-centered or student-driven curriculum. And I think that's a very fine line. And that question's causing me to think a lot, because certainly we do give them the curriculum, and we do set the goals for where they go. So in other words, we we give them the kind of boat that they're going to sail on, and we point them in the direction that we hope to end up at the end of the year or the end of the semester. But how they go about getting there is what I think is really the difference. And certainly they draw upon their own personal experiences. I was just, this is the first week of school, and I was just reading today responses to a narrative questionnaire that I gave my students. And in this citizenship education class, one of the questions that I asked on the survey was, are you aware of your parents' political affiliation or who they voted for in the last election? And I had one student who it was curious to me that he wrote on his survey that he knows, but it's none of my business, and he didn't want to tell me. And then there were some consistent questions on his survey that led me to believe that he really does, that politics and worldview, his parents' worldview, is very secretive and not meant to be shared. And so and that's a challenge for me as a teacher, not just in terms of identifying political ideologies, but in terms of making the connection between ourselves as individuals and good people and ourselves as good citizenship. We actually used a quote of Jonathan Kozol's where he said the job or the role of public schools is not to educate, create good people, but to create good citizens. And I think that sort of gets at the heart of that.
How do you provide for discussion or recognition of any conflicting viewpoints that come up in the course of discussions and all?
That is a very interesting challenge for anyone who teaches and who wants to bring an issues-based curriculum into play, because, as I had said earlier, I'm not in the business of trying to teach my point of view to the students, though I may feel passionately about peace. If I have a student in my peace studies class, as I did last year, I had a couple of kids who had relatives serving in Iraq. They were interested in peace, but they also were interested in the fact that they had relatives who were serving in Iraq and were actually in the war. And I needed to value their point of view and make my, I think the issue is to make my classroom a safe place where all views are welcomed and we can talk about them and we can think critically about them in a way that may never change anyone's mind, but hopefully encourages them to think and to understand that there are many different viewpoints about any given issue. So it's very tricky, and certainly I'm sure we're not always perfect about doing it. I do tell the kids at the outset of the peace studies class that this is a class about peace, and I feel passionately about peace. I'm going to inform them about peace events in the area, and I'm going to encourage them in any way I can to help make peace in the world. I don't think anyone would necessarily disagree with that as a focus, but when you get into a political discussion about whether we should be in Iraq or not, then clearly there are going to be many, many different opinions expressed. So I think that's one reason, actually, that I tried to create a curriculum that was looking at peace as a positive construct, so that I could avoid, in some way, having to take a side or having to listen to kids bicker on subjects that we all don't know enough about. And then again, we also have to take into account the media and the role that the media plays in all of our lives and examine that from many different angles as well, and how the media has shaped our views and our values. So, you know, I think, as Melinda mentioned earlier, it's all about the fact that we are all different people and we all need to be working together in this classroom for this length of time every day, and sort of how to do that to value everyone's opinion and voice.
My job as a classroom teacher is to create a safe and trusting environment in which all voices can be heard. There are differing opinions. This is a very interesting community, Lee Durham Madbury. The perception is that it's a more liberal New Hampshire community. However, that may not necessarily be the case, and while it looks like we have a homogeneous population of students, we don't. There's quite a range of views. I use a quote from a great thinker that goes something like this: out of the clash of differing opinions comes the spark of truth. And I use that quote to encourage my students to know that they may disagree with a classmate, but that it's okay for them to express those views And that's not to say that I feel like I have successfully created that kind of an environment where all students feel that their voice is valid. I think that, I would have to say that I've had situations where students feel that their voice is in the minority, regardless of which side of the fence they're sitting on. They sense that through their peers. They sense that in the direction that the curriculum moves. For example, in my citizenship education class, I do a unit on protecting the commons. It implies that our environment is worth protecting, and it is the role of citizens and political structure to work together to protect and enhance the environment, whereas there are some students that may believe that quite the opposite is true, that the environment is just here and that there are no limits to our growth and we just, you know, need to build and take. It's a challenge for me to find a space or to be able to, I guess you have to say, suppress my agenda and allow those voices and create a space where students are able to dialogue with one another. Moral development-wise, adolescents really see things in terms of black and white and right and wrong. And I do always try to encourage students to know that there's no one right answer at this moment. There's just different views, and it's through sharing those different views that young people begin to shape and formulate their own worldview.
You're listening to Making Waves on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. I'm Damon Thomas. My guests today are Kay Morgan and Melinda Salazar, and we've been discussing and exploring the topic of teaching peace in the public schools. A couple more questions for each of you. What sort of feedback have you had from students who have completed your courses and have had a chance to participate in some of these discussions you've raised? What's been their feedback? What's been their response? Maybe from students who have graduated from the school or after the course has been completed?
Well, every year around Thanksgiving and into the Christmas, December holiday season, we have students who return after they've gone off to college, for particularly their first semester. They'll usually come back and stop in. And of course, you know, the students who stop to see me are probably those who really liked my classes. So, I mean, I can only tell you that students in general seem to respond very positively to the methodology that we use in the English department, and they respond very positively to the curriculum that we've had. They always seem to indicate that they've been well prepared for college. Specifically, this past year, I received a letter from the president of Guilford College down in one of the Carolinas, North Carolina, I think it is, specifically about a student who had gone there, and she had emailed me to indicate that she is pursuing a course of study in peace education, and she'd emailed me with texts, and that kind of student communication after they leave, I think, would tell me that the class has had an impact. I have students who have become active participants in various community-related causes. I think one of the things that our curriculum does, whether it's in peace studies or in any of our other classes, is that it gives students a sense of empowerment that they can make a difference, whatever the cause might be that they want to try to champion. So I would say student feedback is very positive, but then again, as I mentioned, the students who come back to see me and talk about, you know, postgraduate experiences would definitely be those who are positive and made a positive connection with me. So I'm sure there are maybe some students out there who wouldn't say the same thing, but that's the feedback that I get generally.
I'd like to first acknowledge that there are many other teachers in this high school that are doing very amazing service-oriented activities. It would not necessarily be just the two of us whose students would have some positive feedback about our curriculum. Having said that, speaking for myself, I do know that in the years past when I tended to teach a larger number of freshmen in the World Cultures class that we offer, more than I am teaching freshmen right now, they've gone on as upperclassmen to participate or start organizations and clubs in the school, such as Amnesty International. I've had students that have participated after 9/11 in an organization that I helped to advise, the Durham Youth for Peace and the Race Unity Club. And I would have to say that both of those groups, Durham Youth for Peace and Race Unity Club, have also involved some grant writing to different organizations, one to Haymarket People's Fund, where they were awarded a $750 grant to paint a mural in downtown Durham. It never did happen, but we've rolled over some of that money into the Race Unity Club, where we have a scholarship for a graduating senior and have run a mentorship. They've received funding through Teaching Tolerance, the educational outreach at the Southern Poverty Law Center. I've had students who have graduated and have gone on to declare majors in international affairs and international law. The feedback here has been, and again, from those students who benefited from our classes, have really come to appreciate the more broad and global perspective that we've been able to provide in our classes. And I think that that's a real feather in our school's cap, as well as the community, to have students that have gone on and are devoting their lives to a non-governmental organization or service work.
What has been the response of school administrators or fellow educators with respect to the material that you teach?
I'd say for the most part, very, very supportive and interested in working with us to find new curriculum and to create activities. I mean, we have International Peace Day coming up on September 21st, and Melinda and I have been talking for a while about what could we do on that day to mark the day. Our first stop was our principal's office to talk with him about some of our ideas, and he immediately said, what a great plan. We're hoping to bring Pontine Movement Theater and their Portsmouth Peace Treaty production to the school, and we'll also have a conflict resolution type of workshop presented that day. We were thinking in smaller terms last year. We had a big banner up to proclaim the day, and various teachers in different departments got involved. World Language Department teachers made banners in their particular language, and students wrote messages of peace in that foreign language. So the downstairs corridor was full of those big banners. We had a couple of girls who came and asked if they could pass out white ribbons to mark the day, and they were able to do that. So we had almost everyone was wearing white ribbons. So I think it's really a community effort. It's not just the two of us. I think we couldn't do it if we didn't have the support of the principal and the superintendent's office and school board. So I'd say we have a lot of support in the community at large, as well as in the community here at the high school.
I think teaching is a very lonely activity. We come together as a faculty in the beginning of the school year, and sometimes we don't see each other in a large building until the end of the school year. Kay and I happen to be neighbors and need to walk at the end of the day. Much of the planning, the idea, the conception, the implementation of our Teaching Peace Conference that we organized last year on April 9th. This year will be held on April 15th, and taxes are not due until that next Monday, if teachers are listening and would like to attend. The idea and planning of that event came through our afternoon walks. I think that if teachers had more time to get together with each other to just brainstorm and to share aspects of their lives that may not be obvious from what you see in the usual teaching day, I think that we could have much more collaboration and a lot of really interesting ideas. I think that we really all, basically all human beings, want the same thing, which is to be loved and to be accepted and to want good things for our students. When we look at peace education as a transformative experience that gets at building those values, those attributes and qualities, I think that the potential for planning lots of really interesting ideas exist, and that what our political affiliations are and how we feel about the war in Iraq are really, in some ways, they're really secondary to what's important in building a culture of peace in a school.
I'm wondering if each of you could comment on how each of your personal journeys has inspired or has led you to do the work that you do. Melinda, I might start with you because I know you might have a few things to maybe say about this particular topic.
My first experience with the idea of war as a human activity was around the age of 5, lining up in kindergarten or first grade against the wall to practice air raid drills. And I have a distinct memory at that age. It's so vivid in my mind. I can see the shoes I was wearing, the skirt I had on, everything. I just remember so much being thankful that I was born female so that I wouldn't have to fight in a war. And then the next experience, I guess, with war, other than learning about it in history classes, is losing classmates to the Vietnam War. And then it wasn't until I was in college, an undergraduate, as an anti-war activist, that I began to develop some ideas about peacemaking, and then certainly as a member of the Baha'i community, where the starting point begins with war is not only possible, but the next inevitable stage of humankind.
In some ways, I came to peace education late in life and later on in my teaching career, but I think that a transformative experience for me early on was in 1971 when my oldest child was born, and he was a son, and I certainly knew that I never, ever wanted him to have to be drafted. And was I able to act on that at that point? No, I wasn't. But I think that it was always in the back of my mind that I never wanted to see another conflict like the Vietnam War. So following that, when we moved to the Seacoast area, I did get involved in Seacoast WAND, and I've held signs outside of Pease Air Force Base and demonstrated in quite a few different venues as part of that organization. And I think that more recently, for me that's like the last 20 years probably, I've become more of an activist in many ways, and certainly the peace movement is a part of that whole general feeling that I want to be more active in trying to change things. And I would say that Howard Zinn, I've taught the American Studies class for 10 years, and I'm not teaching it this year, but we used Howard Zinn's A People's History as our major text, and we gave the students a chapter from his autobiography, You Can't Stay Neutral on a Moving Train, and I think that had a profound effect on me. The idea, up to that point, I really had felt that as the teacher in the classroom, I should keep my opinion to myself and not let the students know what I thought about anything. And in his article, he talks about how wrong that is and what a mistaken impression it gives to students if they think that their teacher doesn't have an opinion on a particular topic. So it made me think a lot about my role in the classroom and how and in what way it would be appropriate for me to share my opinion and my values and my feelings with my students. Reading that piece by him was a transformation in my life.
Yeah, I'd like to ask each of you, if you could provide our listeners with any concluding remarks or final thoughts, maybe some point that we haven't addressed thus far, or maybe one that we have, something that's particularly of importance to you. And Melinda, I might start with you.
I think I would like to direct educators and parents, community members, to United Nations documents. And while these documents are soft law, meaning that they're not enforced, even signatory nations have difficulty enforcing human rights or environmental violations, the documents provide a standard by which we can begin to look not just at our rights. I think in the West, we're very rights-oriented. The East, or indigenous communities, are far more responsibility-oriented. And by examining the United Nations documents, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Declaration of the Rights of the Child, Agenda 21, the Rio Declaration, we can begin to develop in our classrooms an examination of what responsibilities we play, not just what do we expect to get from the earth and the communities in which we live, but what can we give? That's just one thought. Also, I'd like to mention an examination of economic development theories and capital growth based on an economy that ignores the impact that capitalism has on natural and human stocks. I think that that would be one way to get a realistic view of how much we've been taking from the planet on which we live. And also the work that Blanche Milligan and the Portsmouth Peace Treaty Anniversary Committee has been doing in its way of creating peace curriculums that teachers can use. and the ways that they've been able to network with community groups and bring alliances of people together in honoring a particular historic event.
I have a much shorter answer to this question, and in some ways a much more simplistic one as well, I think. And I'm probably talking to an audience of people who may already do this, but I think I would encourage everyone who's listening to just think about how they can make a difference to make the world a better place. And that's on the one hand so simple, and yet it's also so complicated. So I truly do believe what I try to impress upon my students, that peace begins with each one of us. And so I think that if there's a situation in our life that is causing conflict, we owe it to ourselves and to whoever the other person might be in the conflict to try to find some kind of resolution. And I'm firmly convinced that if we each did that in small steps, then we would end up with a world that is much more peaceful overall. So I really think that, you know, look within and think about your own life and your own commitment to trying to live a better life, and a better life not just for yourself, but for all the inhabitants of the planet. So it's sort of along the same lines as what Melinda's saying, but sort of bringing it back to a very personal level.
I want to just footnote my comment and underscore Kay's that peace does begin at home.
And I want to thank both of you for appearing in today's show. My name is Damon Thomas, and I've been your host for this particular segment. My guests have been Kay Morgan and Melinda Salazar here on Making Waves on WSCA LP 106.1 FM in Portsmouth.
That was Tony Childs with House of Hope.